have been felt by a woman, one must then examine what a woman is and how this despicable sex has been seen from antiquity to our own times by 3/4 of the peoples of the earth. Now, what do I see when I proceed to an objective study of this question? A puny creature, who is always inferior to man, infinitely less handsome than he, less ingenious, less wise, constituted in a disgusting fashion, entirely opposite to what may please a man, to what may delight him. An unhealthy creature for 3/4 of her life, incapable of satisfying her husband during those times when nature subjects her to childbearing, sour, cantankerous, and haughty in temperament, tyrannical if she is accorded rights, base and grovelling if she is in subjection, yet always false, always mean, always dangerous. A creature so perverse, finally, that it was seriously debated at several sessions of the Council of Macon as to whether this bizarre individual, as different from man as the ape in the forest, could lay claim to the title of human being, and whether this could reasonably be granted to it. Yet could this be an error of that time, and is woman more favourably regarded by earlier generations? Was this odious sex, which we now dare to idolize, honored by the Persians, the Medes, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans? Alas, I see her at all times oppressed, everywhere rigorously kept apart from serious affairs, everywhere despised, demeaned, shut away. In short, women are everywhere treated like beasts that one makes use of when required, and that one then immediately shuts away again in the harem. If I pause for an instant in Rome, I hear Cato the Wise cry out to me from the world's ancient capital, "If men were without women, they would still converse with the gods." I hear a Roman censor begin his harangue with these words, "Gentlemen, if it were possible for us to live without women, we would then know true happiness." I hear the poets sing in the theatres of Greece, "Oh, Jupiter, why were you obliged to create women? Could you not have given birth to humans by better and wiser methods, in short, by means that would have spared us the scourge of women?" I see these same people, the Greeks, hold this sex in such contempt that laws were required to force a Spartan to procreate, and that one of the sentences of these wise republics was to force a wrongdoer to dress as a woman, that is, to clothe himself as the vilest and most contemptible creature they knew. But there is no need to look for examples in centuries so far removed from us. How is this wretched sex seen even today all over the world? How is it now? I see women shut away throughout the whole of Asia, serving there as slaves to the barbaric whims of despots who molest and torment them, who make play of their suffering. In America, I see races human by nature, Eskimos, practice every possible kind of benevolence amongst men, and treat women with every conceivable harshness. I see them humiliated, prostituted to strangers in one part of the world, and serving as currency in another. In Africa, where they are doubtless far more downtrodden, I see them doing the work of beasts of burden, ploughing the soil, sowing the land, and serving their husbands on their knees.
Shall I follow Captain Cook in his new discoveries?
Will the charming Isle of Tahiti, where pregnancy is a crime that sometimes leads to the mothers being put to death, offer me happier women? On other islands discovered by this same mariner, I see them beaten and tormented by their own children, while the husbands themselves join their family in treating them more harshly still. Oh, Therese, do not let any of this amaze you, and do not be any more astonished by the widespread rights that husbands have had over their wives since time immemorial. The closer people are to nature, the more they follow its laws. A woman can have no other relationship with her husband than that of a slave with her master. She certainly has no right to pretend to any higher status. One must not confuse with rights those absurd abuses which, while degrading our own sex, elevated yours for an instant. One must look for the cause of these abuses, say what they are, and thereafter follow once again the wise counsels of reason. Now, here is the origin of that fleeting respect that your sex won in times past, Therese, and which still today, and without their realizing it, takes advantage of the goodwill of those who continue to show this respect. Among the ancient Gauls, that is, in the only part of the world where women were not entirely treated like slaves, they would predict the future and bring people good luck. The people imagined that they succeeded in this practice only because of the close commerce they doubtless had with the gods. Hence they were, in a way, associated with the priesthood, and enjoyed a measure of the consideration shown to the priests. Chivalry was established in France according to these prejudices, and finding them favourable to its spirit, it adopted them. But as with all else, the causes were forgotten and the effects endured. Chivalry disappeared, but the antiquated notions it had nourished increased. This ancient respect accorded to an imaginary status did not die away, even when the basis of this status disappeared. Witches were no longer respected, but whores were venerated, and what was worse, men continued to slit each other's throats for them. The minds of philosophers should no longer be influenced by such platitudes, and putting women back in their proper place, as willed by nature and acknowledged by the wisest peoples. They should see women only as individuals created for their pleasure and subjected to their whims, as creatures whose weakness and spitefulness should deserve nothing but their contempt. However, not only have all the peoples of the earth enjoyed the most extensive rights over their women, Therese, there have even been those who condemned them to death as soon as they came into the world, keeping alive only a small number necessary for the reproduction of the species. Those Arabs, known by the name of Korays, used to bury their daughters as soon as they reached the age of 7 on a mountainside near Mecca, because, they said, such a vile sex seemed to them unworthy of staying alive. In the harem of the king of Akkum, if there was even the suspicion of infidelity for the slightest disobedience in the service of the prince's pleasures, or as soon as they inspired disgust, they immediately received the most awful punishment. On the banks of the Ganges they are obliged to sacrifice themselves upon the remains of their husbands, being of no more use in the world once their masters are no longer able to enjoy them. Elsewhere they are hunted like wild animals, and it is an honour to kill many. In Egypt they are sacrificed to the gods. In Formosa they are trampled underfoot if they become pregnant. Under Germanic laws, he who killed a female stranger was fined only 10 aku, or nothing at all if she was his own or a courtesan. In short, everywhere, I repeat, everywhere I see women being humiliated, molested, everywhere sacrificed to the superstition of priests, to the barbarity of husbands, or to the caprices of libertines. And because I have the misfortune to live in a nation that is still primitive enough to lack the courage to abolish the most absurd of prejudices, I am supposed to deprive myself of those rights that nature grants me over their sex. I should renounce all of those pleasures arising from these rights. No. No, Therese, that is not fair. I shall conceal my behaviour, since I must. But in this retreat where I hide away, I shall compensate myself in secret for those absurd restrictions that legislation imposes on me. And here I shall treat my wife according to the rights granted by all the laws of the universe, of nature, and of my own heart.
Oh, monsieur, I said to him, it is impossible to convert you.
That is why I would not advise you to undertake it, Therese.
Gernand replied,
the tree is too old to bend. At my age one can take a few more steps on the road of evil, but not a single one on the road to good. My principles and my tastes have made me happy since my childhood. They have always been the sole basis of my behaviour and my actions. Perhaps I shall go further. I feel that it is possible. But not to turn around, no. I hold the prejudices of men in too much horror. I hate their civilization, their virtues, and their gods too profoundly ever to sacrifice my leanings to them.
From that moment,
I clearly saw that I had no other alternative but to use trickery and to join forces with the Comtesse if I was to deliver either her or myself from this house. After spending a year in her household, I had opened up my heart to her all too readily for her not to be convinced of my desire to serve her, and for her not to realize what had first made me act differently. I revealed myself to her even more. She yielded to me, and we made our plans together. We were to apprise her mother of the situation, opening her eyes to the Comte's infamies. Madame de Gernande was in no doubt that this unfortunate lady would instantly come to free her daughter from her chains. But how were we to manage this? We were so securely held, constantly kept under surveillance. Being accustomed to scaling ramparts, I scrutinized the one below the terrace. It was scarcely 30 foot high. I could not see any surrounding wall, and believed that, once we were at the bottom of this wall, we would be on the forest paths, but the Comtesse had arrived in this apartment at night and, never having left it, was unable to confirm my impressions. I agreed to try climbing down. Madame de Gernande sent her mother a letter that was the most likely to move her and determine her to come to the aid of such an unhappy daughter. I stuffed the letter in my cleavage. I embraced my dear, charming mistress, and then, with the aid of our sheets, as soon as night fell, I slid down to the foot of the fortress. Oh, heaven, what did I see, realizing that I was a long way from being outside the enclosure? I was still in the grounds, surrounded by walls, the sight of which had been hidden from me by the great number of trees and the thickness of their foliage. These walls were more than 40 feet high, covered on top with glass, and prodigiously thick. What was to become of me? Dawn was about to break. What would they think on seeing me in a place from which I was clearly planning flight? Would I be able to escape the Comte's fury? There was no reason to suppose that this ogre would not drink my blood to punish me for such a crime. It was impossible to go back, as the Comtesse had pulled up the sheets. To knock at the gates would be certain to betray me, and so I was very close to losing my head completely and hysterically surrendering to the effects of my despair. If I had discerned some degree of compassion in the Comte's heart, such hope might, perhaps, have led me astray for a moment. But a tyrant, a barbarian, a man who detested women and who, he said himself, had for a long time been searching for an opportunity to sacrifice one by draining her of her blood drop by drop in order to see how many hours she might stay alive in this way, there was no doubt that I would become the subject of this experiment. Not knowing, therefore, what was to become of me, finding dangers everywhere, I threw myself at the foot of a tree, resolved to await my fate and resigning myself in silence to the will of eternal God. Finally day broke. Dear heaven, the first object that presented itself to me was the Comte himself. It had been dreadfully hot during the night, and he had come outside to take the air. He thinks he is mistaken. He believes he is seeing a ghost. He shrinks back, courage rarely being the virtue of villains. I rise, trembling, to my feet and prostrate myself before him.
"What are you doing here, Thérèse?"
he said to me.
"Oh, monsieur, punish me," I replied. "I have done wrong and have no defense."
In my terror, I had unfortunately forgotten to tear up the Comtesse's letter. Suspecting I have it, he asks me for it, and I am about to deny it, but seeing the fateful letter sticking out of the handkerchief in my bosom, Gernande seizes hold of it, reads it furiously, and orders me to follow him. We return to the castle by a secret staircase leading down beneath the vaults. The profoundest silence still reigned there. After a few twists and turns, the Comte opens a dungeon and throws me into it.
"Impudent girl," he then says to me. "I had warned you that the crime you have just committed was punishable here by death. Prepare yourself, therefore, to suffer the punishment which you have brought upon yourself. After dinner tomorrow, I shall come to dispatch you."
Once again, I throw myself at his feet, but grabbing hold of my hair, he drags me all around the floor of my cell, repeating this several times, finally hurling me hard enough against the walls to crush me to death.
You deserve to have all four veins opened this instant,
he said as he closed the cell door.
And if I am delaying your sentence, rest assured that it is only to make it all the more horrible.
He is outside, and I am shaking in the most violent manner. I cannot describe to you the night I spent. The torments of my imagination, combined with the physical pains that this monster's initial cruelty had just caused me, made it one of the most dreadful nights of my life. You cannot conceive the anguish of a wretch who awaits her punishment at any time, from whom all hope has been taken away, and who does not know whether each moment she is still breathing will be the last moment of her life. Unsure what sentence awaits her, she pictures it to herself in a thousand different ways, each more horrible than the other, and she thinks the slightest noise she hears is that of her executioners approaching. Her blood curdles, her heart stops, and the sword that will end her days is less cruel than these fatal moments when death threatens her. It is likely that the Comte began by exacting revenge on his wife. The event that saved me will convince you of this, as it did me. I had been in the awful state I have just described to you for a day and a half without anyone coming to help me, when my door opened and the Comte appeared. He was alone, and his eyes gleamed with fury.
You must have a good idea of the kind of death that you are about to suffer, he said to me. Your perverse blood must flow in abundance. You will be bled 3 times a day. I want to see how long you can live like that. This is an experiment I have been longing to conduct, you know, and I thank you for providing me with the means.
And with revenge, his sole concern, the monster makes me stretch out an arm, pierces it, and after 2 bowls of blood, binds the wound. He had scarcely finished when shouts could be heard.
Monsieur! Monsieur!
Cried one of the old women who served us as she ran up to speak to him.
Come quickly! Madame is dying, and she wishes to speak to you before she breathes her last.
And the old woman flew back to her mistress's side. However accustomed one might be to crime, it is rare that the news of its commission does not frighten the person who has just committed it. Such terror avenges virtue. This is the moment when it reclaims its rights. Gernande goes out in distraught mood, forgetting to lock the doors, and despite being weakened by being bled and starved for more than 40 hours, I take my chance and flee from my cell. All the doors are open, so I cross the courtyards and reach the forest without being seen. Just walk, I tell myself. Walk with courage. Even if the strong despise the weak, there is an all-powerful God who protects and will never abandon them. My head filled with these thoughts, I walk on with renewed spirit, and before night has fallen, I find myself in a cottage 4 leagues distant from the castle. Still having a little money left, I am able to take care of myself as best I can, and had recovered in a few hours. I set out again at daybreak, renouncing all thoughts of lodging complaints, whether new or old, and having inquired after directions, I headed towards Lyon, where I arrived a week later, a little weak and ill, but fortunately I was not followed. There, my only thought was to recover my health before reaching Grenoble, where I still expected to find happiness. One day, when I chanced to glance at a foreign gazette, imagine my surprise when I saw crime rewarded in it in the shape of one of the main authors of my woes, crowned with success. According to this newspaper, Rodin, the surgeon of Saint-Marcel, that unspeakable villain who had punished me so cruelly for having tried to prevent him from murdering his daughter, had just been appointed principal surgeon of the Empress of Russia, at a considerable salary. Good luck to him, the rogue, I told myself. So be it, if Providence wills it so, while you, wretched creature, must suffer. Suffer without complaint. Since it is said that trials and tribulations must be virtue's miserable lot, no matter, I shall never take against it. I had not yet seen an end to these striking examples of the triumph of vice, examples so discouraging for virtue, and the prosperity of the person I was about to encounter would doubtless vex and astonish me more than any other, since this prosperity was that of one of those men who had inflicted the bloodiest outrages on me. I was preparing myself to leave when one evening I received a note, delivered to me by a footman dressed in grey, who was completely unknown to me. On handing it to me, he told me that his master had charged him to obtain a reply from me without fail. This note read as follows. A man who has done you some wrong, and who thinks he recognized you in Belcour Square, is anxious to see you in order to make reparation for his conduct. Come to meet him quickly. He has things to tell you which may acquit his debt to you. This note was not signed, and the footman offered no further information. When I declared to him that I was resolved not to reply as long as I did not know who his master was, he said, "It is from Monsieur de Saint-Florent, mademoiselle. He had the honour to make your acquaintance some time ago in the Paris region, and he maintains that you did him a favour which he is anxious to repay. Now that he is in charge of this town's business affairs, he enjoys both a great reputation and wealth that mean he is in a position to show you his gratitude. He is waiting for you." I quickly reflected on all this. If this man were not well-intentioned towards me, I said to myself, is it likely that he would write to me, that he would communicate with me in such a manner? He has remorse for his past infamies. He is shocked to recall that he took away from me what was most dear to me, that by a number of horrific deeds he reduced me to the cruelest state a woman can find herself in. Yes, yes, there is no doubt that he is remorseful, and I would be guilty in the eyes of the Supreme Being if I did not consent to alleviate his remorse. Moreover, am I in a position to reject the support on offer? Should I not rather waste no time in accepting all he is offering to relieve my suffering? This man wishes to see me in his mansion, and his wealth must surround him with people in whose presence he has too much self-respect to dare fail me again. And in the state I'm in, dear God, can I inspire anything but pity? I therefore assured Saint-Florent's servant that at the stroke of 11 o'clock the following day I should be pleased to call upon his master, that I congratulated him on the ways in which fortune had favoured him, and that I was a long way from being similarly blessed. I returned to my room, but my mind was so preoccupied with what this man wished to say to me that I did not get a wink of sleep. I finally arrived at the address I had been given. It was a superb mansion, with a host of servants, and the humiliating looks these rich scoundrels gave me, scorning my misfortune, had quite an effect on me, and I was on the point of withdrawing, when the same servant who had spoken to me the previous day approaches me and, reassuring me, leads me to a sumptuous drawing-room, where I easily recognize my torturer, despite his being 45 years old now, and it's being almost 9 years since I last saw him. He does not get up, but he commands his servant to leave us alone and gestures to me to come and perch on a chair beside the huge armchair where he is seated. "I wanted to see you again, my child," he said with a humiliating tone of superiority. "Not that I believe I have done you great wrongs, not that troublesome memories force me to make reparation when I think myself to be above such things. But I remember that during the little time we knew each other you showed spirit, and this is needed for what I have to propose to you. If you accept my proposal, the services I shall require from you, and the fortune I possess, will give you the resources you need, and which you would hope to acquire in vain otherwise." I was about to respond by reproaching him for the frivolousness of this approach, when Saint-Florent silenced me. "What's past is past," he told me. "That was passion, and nothing more. And my principles lead me to believe that the fire of our passions should not be dampened in any way. When the passions speak, they must be obeyed. That is my law. When I was ambushed by the gang of thieves that you were with, did you hear me complain of my fate? One must console oneself and work hard
if one is the weakest, and enjoy all of one's rights if one is the strongest. That's my philosophy. You were young and pretty, Therese. We were in the depths of a forest. There is no pleasure in the whole world that arouses my senses like the rape of a virgin girl. That is what you were, and I raped you. Perhaps I would have done worse things to you if what I was attempting had not been successful, and if you had resisted my advances. But I robbed you, and left you without resources on a dangerous road in the middle of the night. I had two motives for this second crime. I needed money, not having any. As for the other reason that drove me to commit this act, there is no point in explaining it to you, Therese, because you would not understand it. Only those who know man's heart and have studied its innermost recesses, who have visited the most impenetrable corners of that dark labyrinth, could explain this succession of misdeeds to you.
What, monsieur? The money I had given you, the favour I had just done you, repay all I had done for you with such black treachery. And you say that that is understandable, that it can be excused.
Oh, yes, Therese. The proof is that, having just robbed and assaulted you, for I beat you, Therese, I had not gone 20 yards when, thinking of the state I left you in, I instantly recovered enough strength from these thoughts for fresh outrages which I would perhaps not have subjected you to otherwise. You had lost only one of your maidenheads. I was leaving, but I turned around, came back, and took the other one as well. Thus, it is true that in some people lust can be generated by the very act of crime. I'll go further, and say that it is therefore the case that crime alone arouses and precipitates it, and that there is not a single pleasure in the world that it does not inflame and increase.
Oh, monsieur, how shocking!
Could I not have committed an even greater crime? I very nearly did, I admit, but I suspected that you were already at death's door, and this thought satisfied me, and so I left you alone. But let us say no more on this subject, Therese. Let us come to the matter that made me wish to see you. The incredible taste I have for both of a little girl's maidenheads has not left me, Therese, continued Saint-Florent. It is the case here as with all the other perversions of libertinism. The older one is, the stronger such urges become. New desires arise from old crimes, and new crimes spring from these desires. None of this would matter at all, my dear, were it not for the fact that the means one employs to succeed are themselves most sinful. But as the thirst for evil is the chief motive of our whims, the more criminal our urges are, the more we are aroused. Once we get to that point, the more mediocre our methods, the less pleased we are, the more horrible they are, the keener our pleasure. And so we sink further and further into the mire without the least desire to pull ourselves out. That is my history, Therese. Each day 2 young children are required for my sacrifices. If I have climaxed, not only do I not see the objects of my desires again, but it even becomes essential for the complete satisfaction of my fantasies that these objects immediately leave the town. I should not enjoy the next day's pleasures if I imagined that the previous day's victims still breathed the same air as I, and it is easy to get rid of them. Would you believe it, Therese? It is my debauchery that fills the Languedoc in Provence with the great many victims of libertinism found there. 1 hour after these little girls have served my needs, dependable emissaries ship them off and sell them to the matchmakers of Nîmes, Montpellier, Toulouse, Aix, and Marseille. This commerce, from which I receive 2/3 of the profits, recompenses me amply for what the girls have cost me, and in this way I satisfy 2 of my dearest passions, my lust and my cupidity. But the identification and seduction of victims are far from easy. What is more, the nature of the subjects is extremely important for my lubricity. I want them all to be snatched from those refuges of misery, where the need to stay alive, and the impossibility of doing so, use up all of one's courage, pride, delicacy, and eventually threatens to destroy the very soul, to the point of determining the subject to try anything that seems likely to preserve it, in the hope of securing an indispensable means of subsistence. I have all these hovels mercilessly searched, and you cannot imagine what I uncover there. I'll go further, Therese. Some activity and industriousness, and just a little easing of circumstances, would help them to resist my bribes and would deprive me of the greater number of my subjects. Against these risks is the credit that I enjoy in this town, the waves I make in its commerce, leading to higher prices in goods which, multiplying the numbers of the poor, by on the one hand taking job opportunities away from them, and making it difficult to stay alive on the other, increase in equal number the sum of subjects that misery delivers into my hands. It's a well-known ploy, Therese. Those shortages of wood, of corn, and of other foodstuffs that have been the scourge of Paris for so many years had no other objects but those that promote my interests. Avarice, libertinism, these are the passions that, issuing from gilded mansions, cast a thousand nets over the humble roofs of the poor. But whatever skill I employ to exert pressure on the one hand, if adroit hands do not swiftly abduct the girls on the other, I get nothing for my pains, and the system works just as badly as if I were not drawing upon every resource or calling in every credit I could think of. I therefore need a quick, young, intelligent woman who, having herself gone down the thorny pathways of misery, knows better than anyone else how to debauch those girls who are there. A woman whose penetrating gaze can spot adversity in the darkest of garrets, and whose evil mind can identify the victims to rescue from oppression by the means I make available. In short, a witty woman, without scruples or pity, who will use any means to succeed, to the extent even of cutting off those few resources that, in keeping hope alive in these unfortunates, prevents them from bringing themselves to accept her offers. I had an excellent and dependable woman who has just died. You cannot imagine how far this intelligent creature carried her effrontery. Not only did she isolate these wretches to the point of forcing them to come and beg help on their knees, but if these methods did not succeed quickly enough to accelerate their fall, the wicked woman would go so far as to rob them. She was a treasure. I need only 2 subjects a day, but she would have given me 10 if I had wanted them. The result was that I made better choices, and that the overabundance of the raw materials needed for my operations compensated me for the fees she demanded. This is the woman that you must replace, my dear. You will have 4 women at your command, and 2,000 écus salary. As I say, I need an answer, Therese, and above all, don't allow fantasies to prevent you from accepting happiness when chance and my hand offer it to you.
Oh, monsieur, I said to this dishonest man, trembling at his words, how can you conceive of such lusts, and how can you dare suggest that I should facilitate them? What horrors you have just forced me to listen to! Cruel man, if you were unhappy for just 2 days, you would soon see this philosophy wither in your heart. It is prosperity that blinds you and hardens your heart. You have become indifferent to the spectacle of ills from which you think yourself to be safe, and because you hope never to experience them, you suppose that you have the right to inflict them. May I never get close to being happy if it can corrupt me to such a degree. Oh, dear heaven, not to be content with exploiting misfortune, but to take audacity and ferocity so far as to increase it, to prolong it, for the sole satisfaction of one's desires. What cruelty, monsieur! The most ferocious beasts do not behave so barbarically.
You are mistaken, Therese. There are no tricks that the wolf does not invent to lure the lamb into its traps. These ruses are in nature, and benevolence is not. It is merely a characteristic of weakness promoted by the slave to move his master to pity and dispose him to treat him more gently. It is only ever found in man in 2 cases, either if he is the weakest, or if he is afraid of becoming so. The proof that this alleged virtue is not found in nature is that it is unknown by men who are closest to it. The savage is contemptuous of it, because he kills his fellow man without pity, either out of revenge or greed. Would he not respect this virtue if it were inscribed in his heart? But it has never appeared there, and will never be found anywhere where men are equal. By weeding out certain individuals, by dividing men into classes and ranks, by making the poor visible to the rich, and making the latter fear a change of status that could plunge them into the abyss of poverty, civilization immediately put into their head the desire to relieve misfortune, in order to be relieved in their turn if they should lose their wealth. It was this that gave birth to benevolence, fruit of both civilization and fear. It is therefore nothing but a virtue of circumstance, but in no way a sentiment of nature, which has never placed in us any other desire but that of self-satisfaction at whatever cost. It is by thus confusing all feelings while never analyzing anything that one becomes blinded to everything, and that one deprives oneself of all sensual pleasures.
"Oh, monsieur," I interjected with feeling, "can there be anything sweeter than the relief of misfortune? Leaving aside the fear of suffering oneself, is there any greater sense of satisfaction than that which comes from obliging another? The joy of seeing tears of gratitude, of sharing the well-being that one has just spread among those unfortunates who, though like you, nevertheless lacked the barest essentials, of hearing them sing your praises and call you their father, of restoring serenity to brows darkened by debt, abandonment and despair. No, monsieur, no, there is not a pleasure in the world to match it. It belongs to the gods themselves, and the happiness that it promises to those who have served it on earth will be only the beginning, since they will be able to see or make others happy in heaven. All the virtues spring from this, monsieur. One is a better father, a better son, a better spouse, when one knows the charms that come from relieving misfortune. One might say that, like the rays of the sun, the presence of a charitable man spreads fertility, sweetness, and joy all around, and the miracle of nature that derives from this source of celestial light is that honest, delicate, and sensitive soul whose supreme happiness comes from making others equally happy."
"That's all Phoebus nonsense, Therese. Man's pleasures are determined by the kind of faculties he has received from nature. Those of the weak individual, and consequently of all women, must necessarily lead to moral pleasures that are more strongly experienced by such people than pleasures of a physical nature would be, given a constitution entirely devoid of energy. The opposite is the case for those strong souls who, being far more delighted by vigorous shocks given to those around them than they would be by the delicate impressions felt by those same individuals, in view of their constitution, inevitably prefer that pain felt by these others to any more gentle contact. Such is the only difference between the cruel and the good-natured. Both are endowed with sensitivity, but each after their own fashion. I don't deny that both groups experience pleasure, but I maintain, no doubt with many philosophers, that that of the individual who is more vigorously constituted will undeniably be more intense than that of his opposite. Once we accept these differences, there can and must be a category of men who find as much pleasure in all that cruelty inspires as others experience in benefaction. But the latter will be mild pleasure, while the former will be extremely intense. There is no doubt that the last category will be more real, more true, since it represents the leanings of all men when still in the cradle of nature, and of children themselves before they have experienced the constraints of our civilization. The other category will simply be the product of this civilization, and consequently subject to dubious pleasures totally lacking in piquancy. In any case, my child, as we are here less to philosophize than to reach an agreement, please be good enough to give me your final answer. Do you accept or not the proposal I am making to you?"
"I categorically refuse, monsieur," I replied, getting to my feet. "I am very poor. Oh, yes, very poor, monsieur. But richer in the feelings of my heart than in all the gifts of fortune. And I will never sacrifice the former to possess the latter.
I shall die in poverty, but I shall never betray virtue.
Begone, cried the detestable man coldly, and see to it that I never have to fear your indiscretion, or else you will soon be put into a place where I would no longer have to fear it.
Nothing encourages virtue as much as the fear of vice. Much less timid than I would have thought, having promised him that he would have nothing to fear from me, I dared to remind him of the money he had stolen from me in the Forest of Bondi, and to impress upon him that, in the circumstances in which I found myself, I absolutely needed that money. The monster then sternly replied that it was simply up to me to earn some, and that I refused to do so.
No, monsieur, I responded firmly. No! I repeat, I would rather die a thousand deaths than save my life at such a cost.
For my part, said Saint Florent, there is nothing I would not rather suffer than the vexation of giving away my money when it has not been earned. Despite your having the insolence to reject my offer, I am still happy to spend another quarter of an hour with you. Let us go into this boudoir, where a few moments of obedience will put your finances into better shape.
I have no more desire to serve your debauchery in one respect than in another, monsieur, I answered with pride. It is not your charity I am asking for, cruel man. No, I would not give you that pleasure. It is only what you stole from me in the most shameful fashion. Keep it, then, you cruel man. Keep it, if that's what you want. Look upon my tears without pity. Listen, if you can, without compassion, to the sad voice of need. But remember that, if you commit this new infamy, my loss will buy me the right to despise you forever.
Saint Florent ordered me to leave, and from his awful expression I could see that, were it not for the things he had confided in me, and the exposure of which he feared, I would perhaps have paid for the boldness of speaking out to him too truthfully with some brutal treatment at his hands, and so I turned to leave. At that same moment, one of those unfortunate victims of the debauched man's sordid vice was being taken to him. One of the women whose horrible duties he was proposing I share was bringing to him a poor little girl of about 9 years old, and whose every feature was listless and wretched. She scarcely seemed to have the strength to support herself.
Oh, heaven! I thought when I saw her. How can such creatures inspire any other feelings but those of pity? Woe betide the depraved person who can imagine deriving pleasure from a body consumed by want. Who could wish to steal kisses from a mouth ravaged by hunger, a mouth that opens only to curse him? My tears flowed. I would have loved to rescue this victim from the tiger that awaited her, but I dared not. Could I have done so? I quickly returned to my inn, as humiliated by an ill luck that attracted such propositions to me as I was revolted by the wealth that dared to make them. I left Lyon the next day to take the road to the Dauphiné, still filled with the insane hope that a little happiness awaited me in this province. I was scarcely 2 leagues away from Lyon, on foot as usual, with a couple of shirts and a few handkerchiefs in my pockets, when I met an old woman who came up to me with a pained expression and begged me to give her alms. Far removed now from the hardness of heart whose cruel instances I had just witnessed, and knowing no other joy in the world but that of obliging the unfortunate, I immediately took out my purse, intending to find an écu and give it to this woman. However, although I had at first judged her to be old and infirm, the shameful creature was much quicker than me. She swiftly seized hold of my purse, knocked me over with a vigorous punch in the stomach, and was 100 feet away before I was able to catch sight of her again, and surrounded by 4 villains who threatened me if I dared to approach. "Dear Lord," I cried out with bitterness, "so it is not possible for my heart to open up to any virtuous impulse without my being instantly punished in the harshest of ways."
At that fateful moment, all of my courage abandoned me. Today I most sincerely ask heaven for forgiveness, but I was blinded by despair. I felt on the point of quitting a path that was covered with so many thorns. 2 alternatives presented themselves to me. That of joining up with the rogues who had just robbed me, or that of returning to Lyon to accept Saint Florent's proposal. With God's grace, I did not give in, and although the hope that it rekindled in me was deceptive, since so many adversities still awaited me, still I thank God for having sustained me. The fateful star that leads me, however innocent, to the scaffold, will only ever bring about my death, while other choices would have brought me infamy, and death is a far less cruel fate than this.
I resumed my journey in the direction of the town of Vienne, resolved to sell there what I had left, in order to get to Grenoble.
I was walking on sadly when, a quarter of a league from this town, I caught sight of two horsemen down in the plain to the right of the path, trampling a man beneath the hooves of their horses and, leaving him for dead, riding off at great speed. This awful spectacle moved me to tears. Alas, I said to myself, there is a man to be more pitied than I. At least I still have my health and strength. I can earn a living. But if this unfortunate man is not rich, what will become of him? However much I should have resisted these feelings of compassion, and though it might be fatal for me to give in to them, I could not overcome the strong desire I felt to approach this man and offer him assistance. I flew to his side and revived him with some smelling salts I kept with me. He eventually opened his eyes, and his first utterances were words of gratitude. Even more anxious to be of service to him, I tore one of my shirts into pieces to bandage his wounds and staunch the flow of his blood. This was one of the only possessions I had left, and I was glad to sacrifice it for this unfortunate. Having carried out this first aid, I gave him a little wine to drink. This wretch having completely recovered his senses, I was better able to observe and study him. Though on foot and travelling light, he nevertheless did not appear impoverished, having some effects of value, rings, a watch, boxes, but all severely damaged in the incident. As soon as he can speak, he asks me who the beneficent angel is who comes to his assistance in this way, and what he can do to show her his gratitude. Still being naive enough to believe that a person bound by gratitude must be forever in my debt, I think I may safely enjoy the sweet pleasure of sharing my tears with one who has just shed them in my arms. I tell him of my misfortunes. He listens with interest, and when I have finished recounting the final catastrophe that has just befallen me, the account of which reveals to him the state of misery in which I find myself, he cries, "How happy I am at least to be able to show my gratitude for all that you have just done for me. My name is Roland," continues this sharper. "I possess a very beautiful castle in the mountains 15 leagues from here, and I invite you to follow me there. So that this proposal may not injure your sensitivities, I shall explain to you straight away how you can be of use to me. I am a bachelor, but I have a sister whom I love passionately, and who has committed herself to sharing my solitude with me. I need someone to serve her. We have just lost the girl who fulfilled these duties, and I offer you this position." I thanked my protector, and took the liberty of asking him by what chance a man like him risked travelling without retinue and being attacked by knaves, as had just happened to him. "Being well-built, young, and vigorous, I have for several years been in the habit of visiting my place in Vienne in this way," Roland said to me. "It's good both for my health and my pocket. It's not that I need to be careful with my expenditure, as I am rich. You will soon see proof of this if you will do me the honour of coming to my home, but there is never any harm in being economical. As for the two men who have just insulted me, they are a pair of so-called gentlemen from the area. I won 100 louis from them last week in a house in Vienne. I took them at their word, I meet them today, I ask for what's owed to me, and that's how they treat me." I was deploring as much as this man the double misfortune of which he was the victim when he suggested we resume our journey. "I feel a little better, thanks to your attentions," Roland said to me. "Night is approaching. Let us head for a house that cannot be more than a couple of leagues from here. Using the horses that we will pick up there tomorrow, we will be able to reach my place the same evening." Utterly resolved to take full advantage of the assistance that heaven appeared to be sending me, I help Roland to begin walking, supporting him on the journey, and 2 leagues down the road we do indeed come to the inn he had mentioned. There we share a decent supper together, and after the meal, Roland recommends me to the mistress of the house. The following day we hire two mules, escorted by a valet from the inn, and in this way reach the Dauphiné frontier en route for the mountains. As the journey is too long to manage in one day, we stop off at Virieux, where I received the same care and attention from my employer, and the next day we continued walking in the same direction. Around 4 o'clock in the evening, we arrived at the foot of the mountains. There the road became almost impassable, and Roland advised the mule driver to stay with me for fear of accidents, and we headed into the gorges. The path twisted and turned, rising and falling for more than 4 leagues, and by then we had left behind us all human habitation to such a degree, being so far off the beaten path, that I thought I was at the end of the world, and I began to feel a little anxious in spite of myself. Roland could not help noticing this, but he did not say a word, and his silence scared me even more. Eventually we saw a castle perched on a mountaintop at the edge of a terrible precipice, by which it seemed on the point of being swallowed up. No road seemed to lead there. The one we were following, used only by goats, and filled with rocks on all sides, nevertheless led to this frightening lair, a place that looked more like a robber's hideaway than the home of virtuous people. "That is my house," Roland said to me as soon as he knew I had caught sight of the castle. And when I expressed my astonishment at seeing that he lived in such a solitary spot, he replied brusquely, "It suits me like this." This response increased my fears. In misfortune, nothing escapes one's attention. A word, a greater or lesser inflection in the voice of those on whom we depend, can stifle or revive hope. But no longer being able to take a different course, I kept silent. The road twisted and turned, and suddenly this ancient, tumble-down ruin appeared ahead of us. We were a quarter of a league away at the most. Roland got down from his mule, and telling me to do likewise, he handed both over to his valet, paid him, and ordered him to turn back. I was not happy with this new turn of events, and Roland noticed my reaction. "What's the matter, Thérèse?" he said to me, leading the way to his home. "You are not outside France. This castle is on the borders of the Dauphiné, and is a dependency of Grenoble."
"Very well, monsieur," I replied. "But however did it occur to you to take up residence in such a cutthroat place?"
"The fact is, those who live here are not very honest people," said Roland. "It is quite possible that you would not be very edified by their conduct."
"Oh, monsieur," I said to him, trembling with fear. "You make me shudder. Where are you taking me?"
"I am taking you to serve a gang of counterfeiters, and I am their leader," Roland said to me, grabbing me by the arm and pushing me across a small drawbridge that was lowered as we arrived, and was immediately raised again behind us. "Do you see this well?" he continued as soon as we had entered the castle, pointing to a big, deep grotto situated at the end of the courtyard, where 4 naked women in chains were turning a wheel. "There are your companions, and that is your task. You will do 10 hours' work per day turning this wheel, and provided that, like these women, you satisfy all of the whims I wish you to obey, you will receive 6 ounces of black bread and a plate of beans a day. You must renounce all hope of freedom, because you will never achieve it. When you have died of this hard labor, you will be thrown into this hole that you see next to the well, alongside 60 to 80 other wretches like yourself who await you, and you will be replaced by another girl."
"Oh, dear Lord," I cried, throwing myself at Roland's feet. "Be good enough to remember, monsieur, that I saved your life, and that moved for a moment by gratitude, you seemed to offer me happiness, and that you are now repaying my assistance by casting me into an eternal abyss of suffering. Is what you are doing just? Am I not already avenged by remorse in the depths of your heart?"
"What do you mean by this feeling of gratitude with which you imagine you have captivated me?" said Roland. "You must reason better than that, you puny creature. What were you doing when you came to my assistance? Given the option of going on your way and that of accompanying me, did you not choose the latter on an impulse straight from the heart? In other words, you gave in to a movement of pleasure, didn't you?"
What the devil gives you the right to think that I am obliged to reward you for the pleasures you allow yourself? And how can it ever enter your head that a man who, like me, swims in gold and opulence, should deign to stoop low enough to be beholden to a miserable creature such as you? Even if you had saved my life, I would not owe you anything if you were acting in your own interests. To work, slave, to work. Learn that, in overturning the principles of nature, civilization does not take away its rights. It originally created the strong and the weak, intending that the latter should always be subordinated to the former. The skills and intelligence of man varied the position of individuals, so that it was no longer physical strength that determined status, but gold. The richest man became the strongest, the poorest became the weakest. With the exception of those factors that established power, the superiority of the strong was always determined by the laws of nature, to whom it mattered not that the chains that bound the weak were in the hands of the richest or the strongest, and that they crushed the weakest or the poorest. But nature is oblivious to these impulses of gratitude that you want to attribute to me, Therese. It was never one of her laws that the pleasure derived by a person in obliging another should become a reason for the latter to renounce his rights over the former. Do you find these feelings that you claim in animals that serve as examples to us? When I am dominant over you by dint of my wealth or my strength, is it natural that I should renounce my rights over you, either because you enjoyed obliging me, or because, being a victim of misfortune, you imagined you would gain some advantage by this means? Even if the service were done between equals, the pride of a superior individual would never let itself be cowed by gratitude. Is not the one who receives help always humiliated? And is not the humiliation he suffers adequate payment for the benefactor who, in this respect alone, finds himself to be superior to the other person? Is it not a boost to one's pride to raise oneself above one's neighbour? Does the person who obliges another need any other pleasure? And if, in humiliating the one who is in receipt of the favour, the obligation he is under becomes a burden to him, by what right should he be forced to keep it? Why should I accept being humiliated whenever the person who has done me a favour looks in my direction? Instead of being a vice, ingratitude is therefore the virtue of the proud, just as gratitude is just as surely the virtue of the weak alone. Let people do me favours as much as they want if they enjoy doing so, but they should expect nothing from me.
At these words, to which Roland does not give me time to respond, two valets seize hold of me on his orders, strip me, and chain me up alongside my companions, whom I am forced to assist immediately, without even being allowed to rest after the exhausting journey I have just undertaken. Roland then comes up to me, brutally manhandles all those parts of my body that modesty forbids me to name, heaps sarcastic and impertinent remarks on me because of the disfiguring and undeserved brand that Rodin had imprinted on me, then arming himself with a pizzle that was permanently on hand, he applies 20 strokes to my backside. "That's how you shall be treated, wretch," he says to me, "when you fail in your duties. I am not doing this for any fault already committed by you, but simply to show you how I deal with those who do commit them." I utter piercing cries, struggling under my chains. My contortions, my screams, my tears, the cruel expressions of my pain only serve to amuse my torturer.
"Oh, you'll have other cause to scream, whore," says Roland. "This is only the beginning of your suffering. I'm going to acquaint you with the most barbaric refinements of misery."
Then he leaves me. 6 dark hovels situated beneath a cave surrounding this vast well, and which were locked like dungeons, served as our cells for the night. As the day ended shortly after I had begun working on this deadly chain gang, they came to unfasten me and my companions, and after we had been given the portion of water, beans, and bread of which Roland had spoken, we were locked up. I had been left alone for scarcely a minute when I was able to contemplate at leisure the horror of my situation. "Is it possible," I said to myself,
that there are men hard-hearted enough to stifle the feeling of gratitude within themselves. Can this virtue, to which I would succumb so gracefully if ever an honest soul put me in the position of feeling it, be unknown, then, to some individuals? Can those who stifle it with such inhumanity